Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in beautiful Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Amy Loria. Today we'll hear from noted investigative journalist Dar Jamal, who will be at the Sanctuary next Tuesday to talk about climate and journalism.
Then we're going to have an interview with Iman Faisal Ahmad, who'll be talking about a forum this Sunday in Water of Elite about forgiveness and countering Islamophobia following the New Zealand tragedy.
Later on, we'll have our weekly food diary regarding the closing of a local Stewart.
After that, we'll hear from our own Megan Marone about the activist group Extinction Rebellion.
Finally, we'll be discussing conversion therapy with Cassidy McCabe. But first, news headlines.
Noman Hussein, the operator of the Imocene company involved in the October 6th crash last year that killed 18 people, in the limo and two bystanders in the parking lot of the Apple Barrel Country Store and Cafe in Schoharie, was arraigned Wednesday afternoon on 20 counts of criminally negligent homicide and 20 counts of second-degree manslaughter. Hussein was indicted last Friday.
Hundreds of climate activists rallied at the state capitol on Tuesday to urge lawmakers to enact the Climate and Community Protection Act, or CCPA. This act sets a goal of 100% clean energy by 2050 and would be funded by a pollution tax structure called a just transition. Many other climate activists, however, feel the CCPA's timeline is too slow and are urging lawmakers and the governor to adopt a shorter time frame with stronger enforcement mechanisms.
The Rensselaer County Sheriff's Office stated that they will be reviewing an agreement to the 287G program, which deputizes state and local law enforcement to enforce federal immigration law. The Rensselaer County Sheriff's Office first joined last year in order to check the immigration status of jail inmates. Only two inmates have been turned over to federal officials. The 287G program does not bring in any added revenue, and Rensselaer is one of only 68 counties nationwide and the only one in New York State to participate in the program.
Environmental advocates want to amend the state constitution to include 15 more words, which would ensure every New Yorker has, quote, a right to clean air and water and a healthy environment. The issue was dead on arrival in the state Senate when the chamber was controlled by Republicans, but it's expected to pass with the Democratic Party now in control. If approved this year, lawmakers would have to act on it again in the next legislative session, and then it will be subject to a statewide referendum.
The Time Union reports that Governor Cuomo is threatening to sue the federal government if the EPA certifies that General Electric has completed the terms of its legal agreement to remove PCBs from the river. However, Cuomo acknowledged that he does not know if the state actually has any grounds to sue on. The state does have legal authority to require GE to remove PCBs from the Champlain Canal, which flows into the Hudson River, but so far has failed to take action.
The Daily News reported that Governor Cuomo said he supports pending legislation to allow terminally ill patients to request life-ending medication. The legislation would authorize physicians to prescribe lethal medications to patients who would be required to administer them without assistance. New Jersey lawmakers passed a similar medical aid in dying measure last month. Seven other states have laws safeguarding physician-assisted death.
Lawmakers, activists, and families impacted by violent encounters with the police are urging legislators to repeal a state law that prevents the public release of public officers' disciplinary records. The Times Union says that the controversial statute is commonly used to deny freedom of information law requests made by civil rights organizations and news outlets. The state's Committee on Open Government has advised that the law be overhauled, arguing that New York's courts have interpreted the 40-year-old law too broadly, expanding the definition of personnel records and moving away from the statute's intent. That is it for news headlines.
All right. Up next, we have investigative journalist Dar Jamal, who will join us once again to discuss his new book, The End of ICE, and the way that global impacts of climate disruption have the ways that he has observed the global impacts of climate disruption.
I'm here in the studio today with Dar Jamail, an investigative journalist who's got a new book out on climate change called The End of Ice. Dar, you have come a long way to get up to this point. And next week, you're actually going to be in the sanctuary hosting a workshop on April 16th. But before you wrote on climate disruption, you spent a long time reporting on the Iraq war. Can we just take a minute to establish for our listeners the general trajectory that has brought you to this point?
You bet. It really started back in 1996 when I moved to Alaska, at which point I started spending a lot of time in the mountains, which means I was immediately faced with pretty dramatic impacts from runaway climate disruption that were already happening. Dramatically receding glaciers, freaky weather events like no snow on the ground in Anchorage during Christmas time, etc. So that seed was planted that there was a huge problem long before I even started working as a journalist and went to Iraq. But then, of course, the war happened, and that's how I started my career as a journalist and then stayed on that track for the next 7 years from 2003 to 2010. And then when the BP oil spill happened in the Gulf of Mexico, I knew I was already keen to get on the climate change beat, and that was really my segue into environmental journalism, and then very shortly thereafter into climate disruption, which now I've been writing about for nearly 10 years.
So tell us about the new book that you have out, The End of Ice.
It's a book where I really took a similar template from my first Iraq book, which the whole point of that book was to go out to the front lines and report back to people exactly how the occupation was impacting the lives of Iraqi people. And similarly, I went out to the front lines of some of the hot spots on the planet of where the impacts of runaway climate change are happening the most dramatically and the fastest. So places like the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, where I was there the first week of another major bleaching event that struck that reef back in 2017. I went back up Denali, a place where I'd spent a lot of time when I was living in Alaska, and wrote about disappearing glaciers, to St. Paul Island and the Pribilofs, about how native populations are being impacted, to the Amazon rainforest, to South Florida for sea level rises, and many other places. So the whole goal was to try to really give people a very personal experience of what it feels like to go to these places where the changes are happening so quickly, and write about it from a very personal perspective, as well as going out into the field with some of the leading scientists to bring home the most updated science we have about what's happening.
And going from the reporting on the Iraq war to climate change really seems kind of disparate. Where does conflict and climate disruption intersect?
Well, there's actually several places, the most obvious being that Iraq being a war for oil that should never be extracted from the ground and refined and then burned and emitted as CO2 emissions into the already overburdened atmosphere. So there's that direct link. And then, of course, we look at what's happening across the Middle East now and the conflicts there. You could argue confidently that climate disruption plays a very key role. For example, there was a 10-year drought leading up to the instability in Syria that then devolved into the conflict that we see now. It's well known that the Arab Spring was caused in large part by rainfall patterns shifting and worsening droughts and escalating food prices. That, you know, the spark that set that revolution alight was the vegetable vendor in Tunisia setting himself on fire in protest. And in Egypt, same thing. It was escalating food prices that caused the political destabilization to worsen there, and even leading to the ousting of dictator Hosni Mubarak. So there are many, many direct links to climate disruption and the wars across the Middle East, and continue to be. And certainly now, with the ongoing and worsening refugee crisis across the Mediterranean, that's yet another link.
You mentioned the ongoing refugee crisis. There's a lot of speculation that there will be that huge amounts of climate refugees in the near future. How do you see the political climate right now, you know, accepting these refugees, or how do you see the reaction to these refugees happening?
Well, we do see very disconcertingly this kind of raise the drawbridge, xenophobic, fear-based mentality that the current administration is exhibiting, which is deeply disconcerting. And we see humans being put in cages and demonized and dehumanized and all the horrible ensuing things that come along with that. So that's in full play in our headlines on a daily basis now, which is rather horrifying. And then, of course, we see that contrasted with this same administration that's doing everything that it can to deny the reality of human-caused climate disruption. And then we have the military itself that has consistently been saying that climate change poses the single greatest security threat to them on the planet, and they're already preparing for it. We have the Navy that's actively trying to figure out how to fortify and possibly even relocate many of its naval bases right on the coast, which are now starting to flood. So there's this also kind of strange, ironic incongruity between an administration that's doing what I discussed while having a military that is trying its best to actively prepare for the waves of onslaught of refugee crises and political instabilities across the world that are going to be exacerbated by climate change.
It almost seems like this disparate attitude between the administration and the military, where the military is preparing for this crisis and the administration is putting out this narrative of loosening environmental regulations, climate denial, this push towards a border wall and anti-immigration attitudes almost seems in anticipation of that flood of climate refugees. But unfortunately, many people that I've talked to are disillusioned with the voting system and don't participate. So what role would you say that voting and civic participation, or lack thereof, has played in climate disruption?
Well, that's a good question and a challenging one, because I am extremely cynical personally about the political process in this country. I think we have had ever since money has been allowed to be as heavily involved in our election cycle as it is now, I think any idea or hope of democracy functioning has gone by the wayside. That said, whether it's by voting or ideally by other means, the necessity for civic action at this point, I think it's never been a more critical time in this country. I think it far supersedes voting at this point. I think we are already at a point where a massive organized resistance or even a rebellion against what's happening, whether we're talking about the healthcare crisis or the education crisis or what's happening on the border or any number of probably hundreds of other critical issues that are on the front burner right now, the need for civic activism in a literal sense now is as great as it's probably ever been in this country.
Going back to you mentioned earlier, Native populations, you've been all around the world documenting the cascade effects of climate disruption and these Native populations that have been impacted by that. Can you go into a bit more detail? And did you observe these populations adapting to their changing environments?
Well, the place that I highlighted to really investigate this and really show the best I could how dramatically indigenous populations are being impacted was St. Paul Island and the Pribilof Islands in the Bering Sea off the coast of Alaska. And the Aleut people who live there, there's only a little over 200 of them that live year-round on St. Paul Island. They live a subsistence lifestyle, meaning they harvest shorebirds and fur seals for their subsistence lifestyle, as well as many of them being involved in the commercial fishing industry now. And with the warming North Pacific waters, we're seeing huge disruptions in the food chain, causing calamitous declines in the types of birds that the Aleutian people on St. Paul are relying upon, as well as dramatic decreases in the fur seal population. They are doing their best to adapt, but they're very, very concerned, and many of them are overtly afraid of these declines and what they see coming in the future, because it's not just because they're losing key food sources and key components to their economy, which they are, but their lifestyle, their culture, their spirituality, their storytelling, the passing along of their heritage is all the same thing, and it's all directly linked into the subsistence lifestyle. And so as that lifestyle gets impacted and eroded, literally their entire culture and way of being, including their language being passed on, storytelling, et cetera, all of that is being impacted. So that's what's at stake here. And with indigenous populations, since they typically are the peoples on the planet that are living much closer to the planet itself, they're the ones feeling the impacts the first and the most intensely.
Did you see any ways in which these populations were adapting?
Well, certainly they are trying to augment subsistence lifestyle in different ways, and they're doing things like making additional and renewed efforts to seeing what's happening. So, okay, for example, a class had been set up to start teaching the language because they knew that people weren't getting children weren't getting out enough with the elders and being taught in the subsistence ways for the language and the culture to be passed along. So a class had been set up, and that was being used to promote the language and some of the storytelling and singing to augment what was being lost. So things like that, as well as they were trying to find ways to encourage more of their young people to stay on the island instead of leaving as soon as they became young adults. So there were certainly efforts being made to try to do their best to maintain a sense of continuity in the culture amidst this backdrop of the subsistence lifestyle being eroded.
It sounds like they're facing it with an attitude of solidarity.
Oh, without a doubt, because they certainly are acutely aware, as they have been now for generations since the Western colonial invasion of their lands, that banding together is paramount. That's the first step. That's first and foremost. If they're going to get through anything, they understand far better than others that if we don't band together, there's no way we're going to make it through this. So that's the first step, and they are certainly acutely aware of that.
Dar, we have just a couple minutes left, but experts call Arctic warming the smoking gun of the impending climate crisis, and new reports are showing that sea ice is melting more rapidly than we had initially anticipated, and these cascade effects will continue to accelerate. From your experiences and what you've observed, what are some ideas about how we can limit the extent of climate disruption through our activities and at the same time anticipate and prepare to adapt to our new climate reality?
Right. Those are really two of the key things that I talk about now when I'm out giving my book readings. It's mitigation, which is what can we do to slow the impacts. We're not going to stop anything at this point, but we can theoretically still slow things down. So if we took dramatic enough actions, for example, maybe we could limit the warming by 2100 instead of it hitting 5°C. Maybe we could limit that to 4°C, which would be massive, although still catastrophic. But yes, it's still our moral obligation to do so. And then that really leads us into adaptation at the same time. That I think, firstly, mentally, we have to adapt and accept that we're living in a dramatically new world now, and we have to prepare ourselves for that mentally and psychologically. And adaptation within our own communities, being acutely aware of, okay, we clearly have a federal government that's not going to do anything here to really work actively towards mitigation. So what can we start doing locally to do that? And of course, that starts personally in our own lives, but then hopefully that expands rapidly outward into our own communities. And that's what I'm trying to do where I live. And fortunately, we do have a very active community working along these lines. And I hope that that's something that is spreading across the country. And I do believe on a local level that that is what's happening.
Dar, just very quickly, can you give us a preview of your workshop, Be the Media, the Art of Investigative Journalism?
Well, I'm certainly going to come at this from working in a country that's moving rapidly into authoritarianism and having had a lot of experience working abroad in countries that were authoritarian regimes. I'm going to talk about that. and the need to safeguard yourself and how to be smart operating within that environment, as well as against this backdrop of everything that we just discussed about living on a planet where things like food, water, and security, basic availability are going to be a thing that is going to become more common throughout even Western countries as we move into the future. So where does journalism fit into that as well?
Dar, thank you so much for joining us in the studio today, all the way from Olympia, Washington.
Correct.
Oh, my goodness.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You can see Dar Jamail here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy on April 16th from 4 to 6 p.m. For Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And that, of course, was Dar Jamail. He also will be speaking at 7 p.m. that evening about his book. So we hope that you will be able to join us. And that's next Tuesday, April 16th.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
Next, we hear about an upcoming peace symposium that will be taking place this Sunday. It's a reaction to the unfortunate massacre at the Muslim mosque in New Zealand. And we talked to the imam, who is one of the main speakers and organizers. A peace symposium is being co-sponsored by the Capital District Coalition Against Islamophobia and the Fi and Dawa Center of America on Sunday, April 14th from 2 to 6 p.m. And this will be at the center at 819 23rd Street in Water Valley. This takes place only a few weeks since a gunman tragically massacred 50 Muslims in New Zealand as they worship. We are joined now by Iman Faisal Ahmed of the Fi and Dawa Center. So welcome, Faisal.
Oh, hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, why are the groups organizing this event and, you know, what are you hoping to accomplish with it?
Well, we're really, it's been a tragic couple weeks for the Muslim community. You know, the gunman in New Zealand, he's a self-declared white supremacist. He went into a mosque, he killed 41 people with a GoPro on his head and broadcast it live. Ironically, the first person he met at the mosque said, "Salam," which means peace. Welcome, brother. So, after he... You know, he was the first person that he killed. And then he went to another mosque and he killed another 9 people. And apparently he was on the way to a third mosque. And so it's very disturbing, unfortunately, to see this irrational hatred. The men, women, and children as young as 3 years old killed. And fortunately, there was a hero who was the custodian of the second mosque who actually, you know, tackled him and fought him off. And so we're kind of, as a community, we are trying to counteract the fear and the hatred that he talked about in his manifesto. He has a far right, extremist, white nationalist, self-declared white supremacist views. And we are trying to speak out against this false narrative that there's a war between immigrants and Europeans. And we're hoping we can help to discourage anybody else out there who might have these ideas.
Now, I know there are quite a few, you know, other speakers, just a couple of them, Michelle Davis of Every Town for Gun Safety, Gene Finley from the Muslim Solidarity Committee, Lynn Jackson from the Project Salam, Joe Lombardo has been on our show quite a bit from UNAC, some members of the Water Valley City Council, and also Reverend Sam Trumbore, who's the minister of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Albany. Unfortunately, here in the United States, of course, the president has been inflaming hostility, towards immigrants and Muslims in particular. What techniques will be discussed at this event to, how to promote, peaceful relationships?
Well, I think the first thing is to realize that the rhetoric that we've been hearing in the media about shutting down the Muslim immigration, somebody said there was a prayer mat that was found at the border, and even one of the politicians in the Australian Senate, Anning, he actually blamed immigrants for the massacre. So, this rhetoric is not something that's coming out of a vacuum. The manifesto, he actually openly states that the president of the United States was a unifying factor for white nationalists, and that he was, he was inspired by some of the rhetoric that was being used against immigrants and against Muslims in particular, this Islamophobia. The gunman, he said that he chose that mosque because it was, it was a former church. And he feels, in his mind, he feels that his identity is threatened by Muslims immigrating, and that the European identity is being threatened. And so what we want to do is we want to counteract that false narrative. This deranged belief is symptomatic of the false narrative that is being pushed in the media that Muslims are taking over the West and taking over Europe. And the reality is it's completely, false. It's half-baked statistics. Muslims are less than 1% of the population. They're by no means, one of the videos that the gunman apparently referred to, it said that Muslims have 8 kids on average, which is, shocking. I don't know any Muslim that has 8 kids. And they say that the average European has 1.1 kids, which is really, false propaganda, basically brainwashing of the population, which is being pushed by certain Islamophobic industry. There's an Islamophobia industry that's funded millions and millions of dollars that is trying to scare the population that Muslims are taking over. And we want to really show people that Islam is not about forcing people to believe in our religion, and Islam doesn't believe in that at all. We believe that everybody has the freedom to choose their religion, and belief has to be based on conviction and on certainty and sincerity. So we're hoping that we can have this dialogue and dispel the fear that people have about Islam. We're not imposing, we're not intending, it's not the goal of Muslims to impose Sharia, but rather we want to practice our freedom of religion just like anybody else.
So how will, people here in the Capital District, benefit from attending this event? I understand it's free, though donation is always appreciated, and there is, a dinner that'll be provided of some sort. And besides how people will benefit, maybe give us a brief overview of the program?
Sure. Well, the fear is that we don't want to have another attack like this again, especially not here in the Capital Region. And so the goal behind the meeting here is to let Muslims and non-Muslims come together, eat dinner together, just talk about, good values, the value of forgiveness, of peace, and try to the common humanity that we're all children of Adam. The idea that somebody is superior to another based on his race or his nationality is, goes against the idea of being one human family, that we're all from Adam and Eve, and we all have this shared values like compassion, love, and forgiveness. And so we definitely believe that mercy will overcome hate. And I think the good, nice people coming together and, discussing things, I'm hoping that we can, break down any barriers and build some bridges between our communities and hopefully get, if there is anybody out there who has these kind of thoughts, about Muslims, we're hoping that they'll come and hear the truth about our religion and not be afraid of us or hate us.
Now, I understand people want to make reservations, www.inislamophobia.org. So we have a little bit under about 90 seconds left. But so are there any steps people can take in their own life to promote better understanding and relationships with people from different faiths and cultures that you might suggest?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, definitely the root cause of this, the root cause of this kind of violence is fear and ignorance. So definitely, you know, if we're able to, we encourage everybody to take a moment to learn a little bit about Muslims, about Islam, you know, that, you know, Islam is an Abrahamic faith. We believe in one God. We believe in being good to your neighbors, and in the hereafter, we'll all be accountable in front of God. So it's nothing, it's not a foreign God that we worship, we hope that people can come, and if they do have any questions about Islam, they can talk to us, and hopefully we can dispel any fears that they have of Muslims being our neighbors. And, you know, we're really happy to be here and our new center here in Waterville. I grew up in Albany. I went to school in Troy, and I love the community up here. It's a very nice community. So I hope we can build some friendship, and, you know, everybody's welcome. You know, there's no cost to attend. We're just hoping everybody to come out and share some words of support with us.
We're out of time, unfortunately. It's at 819 23rd Street in Waterville, Sunday, April 14th, from 2 to 6 p.m. And we want to, thank you for joining us here today.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for what you're doing, and I wish you the best with the radio program, and hopefully we can see you too on Sunday if you can make it.
That was Imam Faisal Ahmad, who joined us today in the studio. Thank you to him for joining us. That Pete Symposium he's talking about will be on Sunday, April 14th from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. and will be held at the Fiqh and Dawah Center, 819 23rd Street in Waterville, New York. For those just tuning in, I'm Amy Loria.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary. As part of our weekly food diary, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Amy Halloran speaks with Sanctuary interns Chris and Amari about the closing of the nearby Stewart's location.
Hi, I'm Amy Halloran, here with another food diary on WOOC. With me today, I've got new Sanctuary interns Chris and Amari. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Sure. Amari, what's your last name?
Allen.
And Chris?
Michaels.
Michael. Awesome. So we want to talk today about Stewart's and grocery shopping, because we had a Stewart's close nearby, and that's going to affect what's going on here. So I want some sort of person on the street reflections about what Stewart's mean in everyday eating in Troy. Amari? Okay,
so I felt Stewart's, it was like a cheap way of getting food. And, like, a lot of people that live in this area may have needed that instead of, they have, like, transportation to go somewhere further to, like, provide food for their family. So this was, like, a source for them that was very much needed.
Right. And where people could get, let's just describe Stewart's in case somebody's listening far away and they don't know, that Stewart's is a convenience store, but it started out as a milk store, so you can get milk, eggs, sandwiches, stuff for sandwiches. It's a little grocery store, right? And so what do you, Chris, you said you started to tell me a little bit about this Stewart's in particular.
This, going off with what Amari said, this Stewart's down here in this area, like Glen Ave, the Martin Luther King Apartments in River Street, or a small portion of River Street, they depended on that store because a lot of people didn't have transportation to get to Stewart's on 10th Street or downtown, or heading out that way down to towards Lansingburg. So they relied on that store. That store helped a lot of people and everything.
And when we're talking about this, so kind of everyday snacks and longer-term groceries too?
Yeah, there's like a breakfast, cereal, milk, or just bread if you didn't have bread. Just like canned foods, just like small groceries that could help pass time by so you wouldn't be hungry. It was just like, it was important, I believe.
Yeah. And so how do you feel about it closing?
I would say I feel sad about it closing because that was a main store to go to, ice cream, baked goods, and other goods that they sold.
Well, my opinion on it, I just moved over here, and when I saw, I was like excited. We have a Stewart's right next door. I have a big family, so it was like, that's great. And then I saw that it closed, so it was kind of hard because if you want something and you don't have, like, your parents are at work, and there's like, you can't go to the store because it's closed. So you have to either wait for your parent to get back or call for takeout. It was just much easier if it was open and like convenient.
So it was a real tool for the community.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What if we could shake one of those snow domes and make appear whatever we wanted inside that, what kind of grocery store or food outlet could be there? Like if we could imagine something and say, hey, build this here, what would you guys want to see in that location, food-wise?
That's a good question. Chris, do you want to take this one?
Do you wish it just opened up again?
That would be the best idea.
The smartest idea would be to bring that Stewart's back because of all the daily customers and everyone that used that store, it really did save a lot of people's lives in this area.
Mm-hmm.
So that store had a lot of people depending on it.
For their daily bread, their mm-hmm. daily breakfast, all kinds of things like that. So another one of itself is what would really fill the bill. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like summertime's coming up and Stewart's has like great ice cream and it's like not there anymore. And the ice cream truck comes by, but it's not really the same at all.
It's not.
It's not.
Yeah.
So that is, it's heartbreaking not having Stewart's right there. I'm sure they had their reasons.
Yes. Everything happens for a reason or another.
Yeah.
So maybe something interesting in food will happen there.
Hopefully.
What are your favorite non-Stewart places to shop for food?
Well, I love, Walmart is great. It has like a variety of everything there. And Price Chopper is like a cheap place for, there's still good products there as well.
Yeah.
But yeah.
How about you, Chris?
Sam's Club.
Yeah. Where you can buy lots of stuff. Yep. That's great.
Just got over 4 pounds of goldfish.
Oh, you won. You won the aquarium full. Cool. Well, yeah. Chris and Amari, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Of course.
We'll keep the conversation going. Maybe we'll have more news to report on food in this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This has been Amy Halloran and Chris and Amari here at the Sanctuary talking about food.
And that was correspondent Amy Halloran discussing the closing of our local Stewart's.
This weekend, the group CAPSCI is sponsoring a panel on science activism and activism in the Capital Region. Megan Marone of the group Extinction Rebellion will be one of the panelists. She spoke with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Larry Blood about her work.
Can you tell us a little bit of something about what Extinction Rebellion is for those who aren't familiar with it?
We have to just encourage every human to engage in nonviolent direct action. And that is what Extinction Rebellion is.
So taking people from the point where they're, I'm concerned about this to, I'm going to do something about this as soon as possible right now. I have to.
Exactly. And also trying to appeal to an inner voice within people where you say, you know, perhaps there will be in appealing to the inner voice within people who basically, when you hear a statistic like the Arctic is warming at twice the rate that people once thought, or you see the superstorms increasing everywhere. And then in conjunction with that, you see these insane decisions like building more pipelines to carry fracked gas into neighborhoods that have already been ravaged through time and history by policies that were racist, classist, you know, completely benefiting the powerful, the point of Extinction Rebellion is to appeal to the voice within people that is actually what you could consider the voice of reason, right? Living in a world like that is pretty insane. So as a movement, the whole point is to get rid of the denial, to be like, we do not want to engage in this denial in terms of the fact that we need immediate direct action and that this is a crisis, to quote Greta Thunberg, the house is on fire, and to have people join together to directly communicate in any way how severe the situation is in terms of our ecological situation.
Well, you're obviously very driven yourself. And when did you first become involved with Extinction Rebellion?
I feel very lucky to have friends in Troy, not just the Capital Region, but specifically Troy. Hannah Vanderkolk and Dan Lander both went down to New York City. And basically, Dan had heard about Extinction Rebellion through just reading more and more about climate work. And then in November of 2018, the protests were organized by the Extinction Rebellion in London. And these particular protests shut down all five of the major bridges into London. And at that point, Dan was like, wow, these people are going to the limit. They're demanding zero emissions by 2025, which, again, on the rational brain side of things, you know, I've talked to many people who are like, that's insane. It's not going to happen. We're not going to get down to zero emissions in 6 years. But then there's the paradox of the insanity that if we don't, we are facing sure disaster in every sense of the word. And also that the most vulnerable communities around the world are already being the most impacted by these things. And I'm talking about in the global community, let alone domestically, where you have people right in Troy who, you know, live along these highly polluted waterways and, you know, live in highly polluted neighborhoods where there's lead in the soil of playgrounds where children are playing. But we're talking also about the real way that the superstorms are going to increase and the sea level rise is going to make life real different, real fast.
So many of the forces that feed into climate change have already been feeding into society, causing problems for usually the poor in places where corporations perhaps say, we don't really care about these people. We want to promote our product. We want to put this out. We need to do this. The heck with that.
Yes.
And so this is an extension of what has already been going on for decades.
Maybe
beyond
even centuries.
Yeah, centuries.
You know, maybe even an extension
industrial
of
revolution.
Colonial policies. The idea of looking at indigenous people and just saying that, having this very rapacious view of the land and people. But Hannah and Dan came back to Troy from learning about this movement and then talked to a few friends and explained what they learned at this meeting that was held. And then we went down to an action in January of this year, January 26th of 2019. And we engaged in nonviolent direct action, marching down. It was pretty cognitive dissonance inducing because we marched down Fifth Avenue demanding the Extinction Rebellion demands.
So basically things have gotten too far and we have to act now is what the organization feels, what you feel. This event, which is happening on Saturday, is going to be drawing a variety of people in from a variety of backgrounds, maybe some not quite as shall we say, motivated as others, but all concerned about the same issues. What do you expect to see come out of this?
I'm extremely excited about the panel discussion because I keep reading over the bios of the other women who I'm speaking with, and it's such a mixture. Like, for example, there's one woman who's working on, trying to do remediation through solar, I don't know, this cool method that she'll talk about. And it's a very specific, very technical scientific thing. We also have a professor of anthropology speaking on how she's seeing the way cultural and behavioral patterns are shifting in the face of climate change up in Finland, and how reindeer herders are changing their position. And I know Abby Kinchy from RPI is speaking on her scientific research. I'm an English teacher and adjunct professor of English education. And so I never really thought that I would have an you know, really, well, years ago, I was always involved in politics with things like, you know, trying to go to protests for Mumia Abu-Jamal to be released from prison and, you know, Occupy Wall Street and bringing awareness to corporate issues and the way that there's just been this corporate oligarchy takeover of our country. But in terms of the climate issues, I've been pleasantly surprised that in different groups, especially a group like Extinction Rebellion, there's more space for people who are not necessarily explicitly, you know, who don't have scientific credentials like a PhD in physics or something like that. I'm an English teacher and a big poetry person and writer. And through Extinction Rebellion and through a few other programs, it's a little neoliberal, but Al Gore's Climate Reality Project, we really, I've gotten the message that people from all walks of life are encouraged to join the climate movement.
Well, this is what's needed, is for everyone to become involved in order to really work against the forces of all the people with so much money, so much power, who are moving in the opposite direction, wanting to continue in the opposite direction. And in some ways, what we hope is that with this panel this weekend on Saturday at Sanctuary for Independent Media, that people will find a way to address their own concerns and perhaps connect into activism. What would you hope would come directly out of the panel today on Saturday?
I would hope that people would walk away with a sense of exactly what you just said, that all people are needed in this conversation. And even though from 4 to 6 on Saturday, these 5 or 6 women are speaking on particular issues and experiences and related to their life's work or activism, that ultimately everyone is needed in this movement. If you have eyes in your head and you have a sense of intuition, we all know that the current culture that we're inhabiting is not sustainable. And I hope that it's emphasized that the people who have already been marginalized and are already the most vulnerable, you know, in terms of policies, are going to be even more vulnerable, and that our empathy and our compassion is going to be essential in banding together and just using all of our skills to make noise, make change, and demand that at the very least we stay human in the face of a future that we can't quite predict, but we know things are going to drastically change.
Megan, well, I want to encourage everyone to come down and for the panel. Again, it's this Saturday, 4 to 6 p.m. at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. More information at mediasanctuary.org. Megan, thank you very much for your time and your visit.
Thank you very much, Larry.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Larry Blood with Megan Marone of the group Extinction Rebellion, talking about activist responses to climate change. I will say next Tuesday, Extinction Rebellion is doing their second major civil disobedience action down in New York City at New York City Hall at 9 o'clock, in case you want to join them. Actually, next Wednesday. And we hopefully will get some coverage of that event.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Caitlin Parsons speaks with Cassidy McCabe about the issue of conversion therapy in the U.S. as the culmination of the two-part series.
This is Caitlin Parsons, your Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent, and I'm here with Cassidy McCabe. We'll be discussing a social problem that is important to her and what work we can do in our communities to create change. So, Cassidy, tell us about yourself and what social problem you'd like to see prioritized.
My name's Cassidy McCabe. I use she, her, and they, them pronouns. A social problem I'm really focused on is the practice of conversion therapy in the United States, particularly. I'm very vocal about it. For people who may not know, conversion therapy is the practice of pathological conditioning of LGBTQ people to become averse to their sexuality and or gender identity. That's the dictionary definition. Basically, it's human torture on LGBT people in order to force them or assimilate them into a cis straight gender normative culture. Currently, it's still legal in 35 states, the most recent ban being in New York with the passing of GENDA. And in Massachusetts, there's a bill going on that just passed the House that banned conversion therapy, and it's expected to pass through the Senate. Or we don't know if it's going to pass through the Senate, but I guess the governor has said something being like, yeah, he's agreeing to this bill. As long as it passes through the Senate, then it'll be banned in Massachusetts.
So what impact does this social problem have on your community specifically?
Well, with the practice of conversion therapy as a whole, it's completely anti-LGBT, especially since it's still like advertised specifically towards parents. The people who are most at risk by conversion therapy are minors, people who still are under the legal obligation of their parents. Conversion therapy can be feigned as also reparative therapy. So if someone who is like a young person identifies as like a trans girl, we'll say, for example, and she comes out to her parents and her parents are like, we don't know how to deal with this, they might look for some sort of therapy to help with their child. Sometimes that can be in the circumstance of reparative therapy. One really big situation that happened a couple years ago is the case of Lila Alicorn. She was a trans girl. She was 16 years old. She jumped in front of oncoming traffic on the highway because her parents forced her through conversion therapy for a full year.
That's terrible.
Her parents were not accepting of her identity at all. They buried her in a tuxedo with her dead name, and they had gone through conversion therapy through the church. A big rise for the banning of conversion therapy happened after Lila Alicorn's death because vigils were held throughout the entire world in response to this. Even some of the laws that was proposed, specifically the federal ban of conversion therapy was proposed, called Lila's Law. President Obama, he had openly said he supports the idea of this bill. It did not pass.
And so, when was that?
That was back in 2014.
That's a shock throughout the entire community.
Yeah, it's still very prevalent.
Of course, of course. So how many states you said currently allowed conversion therapy?
35 states.
35
still
states.
Have legal access to conversion therapy. Bans, particularly, only ban conversion therapy on minors because of the idea that, oh, well, once you're past 18, you have full consent over yourself. But it doesn't factor into consideration the social implications around mm-hmm. wanting to convert, or the parental guidance past the age of 18, like parental coercion or religious coercion, because mm-hmm. While it's not explicitly tied to religion, the majority of conversion therapy following is in religious spaces, specifically Christianity.
So are you familiar with any organizations or local individual efforts that work to combat this issue?
Basically every LGBT organization that I can possibly imagine is against conversion therapy. I know Trevor Project is very vocal about it. The National Center for Lesbian Rights, Human Rights Campaign, actually were the creators of GENDA that passed through New York. Before GENDA passed, a bill called ENDA had passed that was banning employee discrimination in the workplace based off sexual orientation. Mm. It was called GENDA, but they removed the G because when they first passed it, they didn't feel that gender identity would be passable to get that bill passed. So they've dropped gender identity from the thing and just had sexual orientation. With this one, they finally got gender identity through. And with that, they slipped in conversion therapy to make sure that that was removed from New York State, because back in 2016, Cuomo had passed a bill making it so conversion therapy can't be covered by insurance. But that doesn't stop people from going through conversion therapy. It just mm-hmm. stops it being covered by insurance. So it just makes it expensive.
Right.
With the banning of conversion therapy, it's only by medical professionals. If you're going through your church or like your priest or whoever is the one who's converting you, that's not going to be caught in the eyes of the law. It's only if it's a medical professional, which, let alone most medical professionals, I can honestly say most medical professionals are against the idea of conversion therapy. It is against the code of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That I believe it's the American Psychological Association is against. It says it's against the code of ethics.
So what work, if any, are you doing to make a positive impact?
Well, since I'm still in school, some of the biggest things I've done is just spread information. Mm-hmm. I've written two full research papers on this, as well as just making sure letting as many people as possible know how pervasive and how prevalent this issue still is. Also, back in 2018, I went to the Planned Parenthood Day of Action, and one of the policies on the women's agenda that Planned Parenthood had made is the banning of conversion therapy. It was, I think of, there was like four spots, and I think it was number three. And so when I was speaking with representatives for New York State with that day of action, I was talking about conversion therapy. And everyone I spoke to, besides the people who turned their door and said, closed their door and said, we're not talking to Planned Parenthood, they heard about conversion therapy. Some of them didn't even know it happened, mm-hmm. and they were shook. Thankfully, they're against it.
Right, so. Of course. And do you feel that these efforts are enough, or should we be doing more?
So far, the bans, I feel like, are like a halfway mark for success. It's a great start, at least, to ban the practice on a state level. I think, of course, there needs to be a federal ban. It's like the allowance of same-sex marriage. Like, that should have, thankfully, that was allowed on the state level for many states, but it needed the federal level mm-hmm. allowance in order to allow people across the entire country allowed to get married. And it's the same with conversion therapy. We need to protect our children. We need to protect our youth, LGBT people overall. And let alone, I think that it's a halfway mark just because the ban only affects state licensed practitioners. So if you're a victim of conversion therapy through your church, where you're very likely to go through your church or by your family somehow, like your family is the one who are doing it. Like if your father's a pastor and he decides he's going to convert you, like they're not certified. So they're not technically under the eyes of the law in that sense. The big thing I think is that, especially since the majority of victims of conversion therapy are minors, by the consent of their parents, I think the practice should be filed under child abuse, under violence and neglect of mm-hmm. children, and that parents who are giving aware and informed consent to the practice should be charged with those things, as well as the person who is doing those. So if your priest is converting you, they should be charged with child abuse. And mm-hmm. if your parents are knowingly allowing this to happen, they should also be charged with child abuse. But, and I only say because the parents should, if they are aware of the situation, I think they should be charged, is because there are situations where the parents don't even know. It's just that the parents are like, oh, I want my gay child to go under therapy, but like, I'm really religious, so I'm going to ask my priest to help my child with his identity, his sexuality, and accept himself. And the priest is converting him.
And they don't realize what's going on.
Really. Exactly. Yeah.
And for those of us who also find this to be an important issue, what can we do as individuals to create change?
I think on the individual level, the best thing you can do is be aware and be informed when looking for help and also when giving help, especially with the medical industry. Many of the treatments for conversion therapy are only reduced to human torture, especially in cases where it's done on children against their will because of their parents' beliefs, and even in cases against their parents' knowledge, which it makes it very difficult to find a proper therapy clinic for LGBT children, especially where the practice is legal. It's important to know what to look for because it can be coded as reparative therapy, as I said. And also, just a general gist, if you're looking for an LGBT-friendly clinic or therapy vicinity, look for words like gender affirming, mm-hmm. gender affirmative, and simply just LGBT friendly or LGBT positive. It's probably even useful to make sure that the therapist is also identifying, particularly with the identity of you or your child, if you're looking for therapy for your child. So if your child is a trans person, maybe try to make sure their therapist is also trans because they can relate to that experience. If your child is bisexual, find a bisexual therapist. It helps them find a more relatable experience.
Well, thank you for coming in today, Cassidy. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
And that was Caitlin Parsons and Cassidy McCabe discussing conversion therapy. That concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm Amy Loria. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith.
Thanks for tuning in.